It's 6 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Police released details on suspected gunmen in Copenhagen attacks. Danish police shot and killed a man Sunday suspected in the slayings of two people in Copenhagen Saturday. Authorities say the Denmark-born 22-year-old alleged gunman was fatally shot after opening fire on officers near a train station. Police say his previous criminal record included violence and weapons offenses. According to officials, no evidence suggests other gunmen were involved in the shootings, one at a free speech event and the other outside a Copenhagen synagogue. Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt promised to stand by the Jewish community.
Our thoughts go to the whole of the Jewish community today. They belong in Denmark. They are a strong part of our community, and we will do everything we can to protect the Jewish community in our country.
Prime Minister Thorning-Schmidt called the attacks a cynical act of terror. Denmark's intelligence chief says investigators believe the gunman was inspired by Islamic radicalism. A female suicide bomber in Nigeria killed at least 10 people and wounded 30 others Sunday when she blew herself up at a crowded bus station. The explosion occurred in the northeastern city of Damaturo in Yobe State, with authorities and witnesses saying a girl managed to elude security at a checkpoint before setting off the blast. There's been no claim of responsibility. South Sudan's government is planning to send a proposal to Parliament Tuesday for a constitutional amendment to extend President Salva Kiir's term of office. The move comes after the cabinet called off elections scheduled for June. That vote is now expected in 2017. This is VOA News. The UN Security Council is demanding that Shiite Houthi rebels in Yemen restore the Sana'a government and immediately release President Abdel Rab Mansour al-Hadi. Mr. al-Hadi and his ministers were detained last month when rebels toppled the government. Abdel al-Mualimi is the Saudi ambassador to the United Nations.
This is a very important milestone resolution for the situation in Yemen. Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. The Yemeni people are pleading for help. They're asking for help.
The demands are included in a resolution adopted unanimously Sunday by the 15-member council. The measure also calls on the Iran-backed rebels to engage in good faith with UN-brokered peace talks. A new video purports to show militants of the Islamic State terrorist group beheading 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians kidnapped in Libya. The video, released Sunday, shows several men in orange jumpsuits being led along a beach, each accompanied by a masked militant. The men are made to kneel, and one militant addresses the camera in English before the men are simultaneously beheaded. Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says his country reserves the right to respond to the mass beheadings, and in his words, Egypt will choose the necessary means and timing to avenge the criminal killings. Italy closed its embassy in Libya and repatriated its staff amid ongoing violence in the country. Parallel governments and multiple armed militias are locked in an ongoing and deadly power struggle since the death of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. A senior UN official says he sees hopeful signs of reconciliation beginning to emerge in war-torn Central African Republic. Head of the Africa Bureau at the UN Development Program, Abdoulaye Mardaye, tells VOA it is vital for the international community to work towards establishing a democratic society. Lisa Schlein has details.
The UNDP's Africa Bureau chief has recently returned from a week-long visit to Central African Republic to assess what his and other UN agencies are doing to support the country's fragile peace process. He says great difficulties lie ahead for peace and reconciliation to take root as the population remains traumatized, deeply divided, and mistrustful of the state. Despite this, he says there is a sense of hope and collective willingness to revive the country's shattered communities and economy. The government is pinning its hopes for achieving a more stable, economically viable society on next month's peace-building Bangui Forum. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pro-Russian rebels battling Ukrainian forces near the Russian border are trying to modify a new truce deal Sunday, saying its terms do not apply to the town where most of the fighting has taken place this month. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Monday, February 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The three most Ebola-affected West African countries promised zero Ebola infection in 60 days.
We want to make sure we nip Ebola in the bud once and for all, and at the same time, we have the capacity to respond in the event of any future eventuality so that we don't have to be caught again, our pants down.
Abdoulaye Birete is Sierra Leone's government spokesman. Guinea scrambles to shut down false Ebola vaccination rumors. Liberian schools are supposed to reopen today, Monday, but many schools may not yet be ready. And France's defense minister to sign a deal to purchase about $6 billion of French fighter jets.
The French government is committed to cutting down the domestic orders for the Rafale. So to make up for that cut, France needs to find export customers for the Rafale.
Pierre Tran is the Paris correspondent for Defense News. Liberian police investigate the mysterious death of a whistleblower lawyer, and South Africa's electricity shortages are hitting the poor hard. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Leaders of the Mano River Union, comprising Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, have committed themselves to achieving zero Ebola infection within the next 60 days, beginning yesterday, February 15th. The announcement came at the end of a summit in Guinea's capital, Conakry, that brought together Presidents Alpha Condé of Guinea, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia, and Ernest Bai Koroma of Sierra Leone. They were joined by a representative of President Alassane Ouattara of Ivory Coast. Sierra Leone government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete says the leaders want to achieve their goal through infection prevention control, social mobilization, and other measures.
Already, we are just cascading all the local efforts we're using at the national level, that is, mobilizing all the contacts, doing more surveillance and social mobilization, and to make sure that there is effective surveillance systems being put in place between and among these respective countries in the Mano River Union. And I think that is very key, because at the end of the day, we must be able to control the borders. That way, if new infections are happening, for example, in Guinea, since we share a border at the fourth case index in Kailao, we will be able to make sure that we prevent that from coming over to Sierra Leone.
Mr. Birete, if these countries do not invest heavily in improving their, crumbling healthcare systems, all this promise will be nothing. Eventually, Ebola may come back.
That is a point that was even raised, that we are now going to implement the African Development Bank Initiative, which is going to deal with how to further strengthen the respective healthcare systems in the countries that are hardest hit by Ebola.
They have made an appeal to the international community to provide all necessary support to achieve this goal. I understand there is supposed to be a particular donor conference coming up, I think March 3rd.
Absolutely. That is going to happen in Brussels, the Belgian capital. And already the heads of state have agreed that President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is going to be their spokesperson in that all-important conference. The reason being, we are very much heartened today in Conakry that the United Nations Ebola Response Coordinator appointed for the sub-region was there as well and reiterated the unflinching support of the United Nations. And that is where going to Brussels is a further testimony that all the plans we are putting in place as a sub-region cannot come to fruition if we don't have the unflinching support of the international community.
It seems to me, Mr. Birete, that the West African leaders do not want the international partners to immediately exit, because some people are thinking that, well, now with Ebola on the decline, it's time to pack up and go.
Yes, that is quite true. We don't want that to happen because we don't want any premature departure.
Sierra Leone's government spokesman Abdoulaye Birete was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. The Guinean government is trying to stem growing panic over false rumors that the Red Cross will begin administering an Ebola vaccine to school children. Parents have taken their children out of school, and angry youth have attacked health workers. Karim Kamara reports from Conakry.
The Guinean government says there are no plans for the Red Cross or anyone else to launch an Ebola vaccine campaign in schools. Health Minister Colonel Remy Lama told VOA the rumors are baseless and were started by people who want to sabotage the fight against Ebola.
Il n'a jamais été question ni de pulvériser ni de vacciner dans une école.
He says the Red Cross could not be able to embark on a vaccination campaign on its own without the cooperation of the health ministry. He says any such campaign could be preceded by a large education and an awareness campaign because people are worried that they could catch Ebola through a vaccination. State television Saturday night showed a man accused by the authorities of spreading the false rumor. Police say the man will soon appear before a judge. The vaccination rumor has spread like wildfire in the past week. Parents scrambled to collect their children from schools around the country. Schools in Kenya and Bokke, large cities in the west of the country, were shut Wednesday and Thursday because of threats from students and parents. On Friday in Farana in Upper Guinea, hungry students attacked and destroyed a transit center of Ebola patients and set fire to a vehicle belonging to Doctors Without Borders. Two of its workers narrowly escaped lynching by the angry student. The health minister says the government is working hard to keep students safe from Ebola.
Le gouvernement a pris toutes les mesures qu'il faille pour pouvoir apporter un démenti à cette fausse rumeur par la sensibilisation.
Lama says the government is involving parents in an awareness campaign it has launched in schools to refute the rumor. He said the authorities are working to keep schools safe. Students must wash hands before classes, and foreign visitors have been banned from school grounds. He said today students are more protected in schools than on the street and in their homes. The wave of panic reflects continued misinformation and resistance to Ebola interventions in Guinea, where this regional epidemic began more than a year ago. The Red Cross says members of its staff in Guinea are being attacked on average 10 times per month. Health authorities have reported such as a threefold increase in infection rate since January, which they blame on people refusing to cooperate with contact tracing. The government says it is working to eradicate Ebola by the end of February, the goal it set at the start of the year. Karim Kamara, VOA News, Conakry.
Schools in Liberia are set to reopen today, Monday, after the Ebola crisis forced them to close last year. But many schools may not yet have all the needed Ebola safety measures in place to reopen. At one school in the West Point area of the capital, Monrovia, some Ebola patients were held in classrooms as recently as January. The principal at N.V. Masekwai School, M. Glad Missy, tells Ricky Schreier that though the school has been cleansed since the patients left, much more work needs to be completed before it reopens.
After the renovation has not yet started, and so we'll not be opening school on tomorrow.
When you say renovations, what do you mean? What kind of renovations need to be done to the school before it can open?
The chairs and other things are in the building to be disposed of, the building to be painted totally, and the roof is damaged at some level because of people climbing over the roof, and it caused total damage to the roof. So we need a total renovation, changing of everything within the building, give new confidence to the community.
You mentioned that the furniture needs to be disposed of and that people were climbing on the roof. Can you give a little background about why the furniture needs to be disposed of and why people were climbing on the roof?
We cannot risk the life of this more than 1,000 students that should be attending the school. There is a concept that everything in the building has been sent away by the Ebola patient. And so there is a sense of new confidence that needs to be built. And because of this, to reassure everyone that the place was disinfected, everything in the building needs to be disposed of. Chairs and other things, the commode in the bathroom. We cannot wait for students to use the bathroom. And because of the commode was used by the patient. The patient vomited within the building. There are some dead patients, dead bodies in the building. And so because of that, we need to get rid of everything there.
When do you foresee being able to open in the future. And I was there yesterday. There were padlock on the door, and then, you know, the desks were kind of all over, and it didn't look like it would be able to open anytime soon.
Will be a month if our attention is given to the school and renovation can start by this week. We think we can get over the deadline.
You think you'll make the March 2nd deadline?
Yes.
That was M. Glett Missing, principal at N.V. Massaquoi School in Liberia. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from West Point in the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. It's 15 minutes past the hour. The director of the Liberia National Police says investigation into the death of a prominent lawyer is continuing. Councillor Michael Allison, former consultant to the National Oil Company of Liberia, was found dead early Friday morning on a beach in his underwear in the capital, Monrovia. He reportedly blew the whistle that led to an ongoing investigation involving the Speaker of the Liberian House of Representatives. Many are suspecting foul play. Police Director Chris Masekwai says a pathologist has arrived from neighboring Sierra Leone to help in the investigation.
Well, the investigation is ongoing by the crime service institution, by the homicide investigators. And we have decided to bring in a foreign pathologist. Of course, we should know we do not have in Liberia. And he just arrived today from Sierra Leone to be able to assist the Liberian National Police in the investigation, but also be able to come up with some conclusion as to the cause or causes of death.
Mr. Director, has there been any autopsy done by the Liberian authorities?
No, there has not. There has been no autopsy done. We do not have a pathologist in Liberia, and so we have to rely on a foreign pathologist.
This does not normally happen with anybody who dies. Why is your department taking this extra precaution?
Well, it is not an extra precaution. It is just part of our SOP, and we have done it for so many other bodies, and it is not just an exception. I mean, we do not have a pathologist in Liberia, and the second cases that are critical to our investigation, we do rely on assistance from other countries' pathologists.
Director Masekwai, the account I read is that Mr. Allison was a whistleblower, and one account said that lately he has been complaining of some threat on his life. Do you have or your police have any record of him complaining to you?
We absolutely have no record of such complaint, and apparently this matter was directly handled by the LACC, and the Liberian National Police investigator have not been a part of this investigation. Had they brought it to our attention, we probably would have assisted to provide protection if so required.
Do you have any suspects? Because I'm reading the article and I'm listening to what the girlfriend of Mr. Allison is saying. Have you talked to the girlfriend?
Yes, we have.
Uh-huh. Did she say anything at all? Because one account said that she said that he drowned. How is that possible when no autopsy have been done?
Well, James, I'm sorry. I mean, you know very well the criminal justice and the judicial procedures. And I wouldn't want to state any speculation or make any remark that will prejudice the prosecution. So maybe at a later time, we might be able to come up with the conclusion of the investigation. But at this stage, I wouldn't want to disclose those information to protect the right of the defendant as well.
Chris Masekwai is director of the Liberian National Police. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. French Defense Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian is due in Cairo today, Monday, to sign off on a $5.9 billion purchase by Egypt of 24 French Rafale fighter jets and a frigate. The deal boosts France's struggling economy and helps bolster Egypt's military arsenal in the face of rising insecurity. But as Lisa Bryant reports from Paris, some are questioning why France is going ahead with a sale to a country with a poor human rights record.
C'est effectivement le premier contrat à l'exportation du Rafale.
After years of trying to sell its Rafale fighter jets overseas, France finally had some good news. In announcing Egypt's agreement to purchase 24 of the aircraft, French President François Hollande said Cairo wanted a quality air force and a quick deal, and it got both. He said Egypt wanted the planes quickly because of threats surrounding the country. Those threats include turmoil in neighboring Libya, but also Islamist terrorism in the Middle East and North Africa. The sale gives the French defense industry a boost after Paris was forced to put on hold the sale of two warships to Russia amid the standoff over Ukraine. It also comes at a time when the government is cutting defense spending. Pierre Tran is Paris correspondent for Defense News.
The French government is committed to cutting down the domestic orders for the Rafale. So to make up for that cut, France needs to find export customers for the Rafale. So Egypt is the first export customer.
It's especially important for Dassault Aviation, which manufactures the fighter jets.
Alors d'abord, c'est une grande fierté pour nous, effectivement, cette annonce et ce résultat. Il y a une simplicité du contrat, il y a une volonté forte.
We're very proud, Dassault's head Eric Trappier told French Radio. He said the Egyptian army has seen the jets in operation and they're satisfied with their performance. But not everybody is pleased.
Vous me demandez si je me réjouis, je pourrais vous dire oui, c'est formidable pour les comptes publics et pour Dassault. Le sujet, c'est est-ce que vraiment les
Emmanuel Coss, who heads the EELV Greens Party, says the Rafale sale is great for France's accounts and for Dassault. But in an interview on France Info Radio, she asked if selling the planes to Egypt is a good idea, given the country's economic and social difficulties, and after Egyptian police have fired on peaceful protesters. The U.S. State Department has downplayed the Rafale sale, saying Egypt is a sovereign country and Washington has its own security relationship with Cairo. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
While South Africa's electricity woes have led to a national outcry over mismanagement of the power monopoly, wealthier residents are coping with electricity outages by the use of generators, gas stoves, heaters, and cookers. But for the country's poor population, the government's failure to supply electricity has switched off their lives. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
63-year-old Sheila Twala has lived in the Johannesburg township of Soweto for the past 14 years. With no source of income, she is dependent on the government-subsidized electricity. But the current failure of the public energy utility, Eskom, to constantly supply her and millions of South Africans with reliable electricity has left her fuming.
We were very happy when we voted for our black government. We were sure that since it's now a black government in power, we will not suffer anymore because the apartheid government oppressed us. But now it's a pity because our black government is making us suffer.
Sometimes she goes for days, at times a full week, without electricity. And there's no end in sight. Eskom, the government-owned electricity monopoly, has admitted that a lack of investment, poor maintenance, low tariffs, huge debt, and delays in constructing new power plants means load shedding will continue for several years to prevent the entire energy grid from collapsing. Those who can afford it resort to using generators, gas cookers, and even solar power during electricity blackouts. But for the millions like Twala, there is no choice. The constant power cuts have rendered her electric stove useless. Her refrigerator has become a food spoiler and her washing machine sits idly. She now has to use a smelly and unsafe paraffin stove for cooking. But Twala and her family of seven need $3 a day to buy the paraffin. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sponsoring here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. First half goal scored by Victor Osimhen and captain Kelechi Nwankari lifted FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria to a 2-0 win over hosts and tournament debutants Niger in Niamey on Sunday. Later, Abubakar Traore's 25th minute strike handed Guinea a slender 1-0 triumph over debutants Zambia in the other Group A tie. Today, Monday, attention shifts to Group B, where defending champions Ivory Coast engage South Africa before Mali play Cameroon. In rugby, South Africa outclassed hosts the United States of America 31-0 to clinch the bronze medal in the main event at the IRB 7 Series in Las Vegas, Nevada State on Sunday. Kenya edged Argentina 24-21 to win the bowl final. Consequently, South Africa retained the top spot at the end of the fifth leg of the series with 93 points. Kenya is 12th with 29 points, while Zimbabwe is 17th with 1 point. In cricket, South Africa rallied to beat Zimbabwe by 52 runs in the first Group B tie for both teams at the ICC Cricket World Cup in Hamilton, New Zealand. They are the only Africans in the 12-nation contest. Turning to athletics, Kenyan defending champion Bedan Karoki won the senior men's 12 kilometers at the IWF cross-country permit meet in the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Saturday. Geoffrey Kamoror was runner-up ahead of the Africa cross-country champion Leonard Barsoton. Meanwhile, two-time world junior champion Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon won the senior women's 8-kilometer race. Dominic Kiptaras clinched victory in the junior men's 8 kilometers, while the world youth 2,000-meter steeplechase champion Rosfina Chepngetich convincingly won the junior girls' 6 kilometers. The competition was dominated by Kenyans and was also the country's trial for the World Cross Country Championships due in China next month. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omar in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Fact for today, February 16. On this day, 1923, blues singer Bessie Smith, known as the Empress of the Blues, made her first recording. It was called Downhearted Blues. Smith sang about things in life that give people the blues, things like poverty, racism, and love that is not returned. Her songs capture the sadness and joy of many African Americans. Also on this day, 1970, Joe Frazier became world heavyweight boxing champion after knocking out Jimmy Ellis in the second round at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On this day, 1972, during a basketball game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Phoenix Suns, Wilt Chamberlain became the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points. Today in Black History, we want to tell you about African-American composer, pianist, and big band leader Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington. Born April 29, 1899, Duke Ellington was one of the outstanding musicians in the world. He led a big band, played the piano, and wrote over 1,000 songs. Both the United States and France awarded Duke Ellington their top honors. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 16th. Congratulations to Jenica A. Kroma of Freetown, Sierra Leone, Alec G. Mbewe of Solowezi in Zambia, and Abigail Mwangele of Nairobi, Kenya. You are the winners of our February 13th question. What's the name of the oldest and largest U.S. civil rights organization? The answer, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, or the NAACP. Now, here is our question for today, February 16th. What prestigious award was given to Dr. Charles Richard Drew in 1944? Once again, what prestigious award was given to Dr. Charles Richard Drew in 1944? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A female suicide bomber in Nigeria killed at least 10 people and injured 30 more on Sunday when she blew herself up at a crowded bus station. That's it for this Monday, February 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sandy Shumari and his guests discussing dress code. This light-hearted show discusses topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, innovators and entrepreneurs are transforming Africa, bringing the continent economic growth, progress, and opportunity. That's next time on VOA Africa.